giant of limitless power at man's command. And where was it science found that giant? In the atom, a particle so infinitely small that it takes over 100 billion atoms to make up the head of a pin.
This is Out of the Basement, a podcast dedicated to radiation medicine.
This is Dr. Jason back to hunker down in the Vermont mountain basement in that exciting time of the year when I get to use a leaf blower for its actual purpose instead of what I normally use it for, which is letting my toddler blast me with the leaf blower while he shrieks with glee. If you have a toddler and a leaf blower and you don't do this, well, you're missing out. What I wanted to do today was in a general theme of previous episode on the, I guess many previous episodes about shared history, and that the intent of this podcast in many ways is decreasing information asymmetry, but specifically talking to myself in the past. And it's a version of if I knew back then what I know right now, and very much so in medicine in general, and especially in radiation oncology, things are very siloed, and that people will quickly forget how the cycle goes, meaning that in a 5-year cohort with the residency up until graduation of residency, everyone has more or less of a similar shared history, meaning that in any given 5-year period, big events, notable events, things that stand out, there is a shared understanding where you don't have to have a backstory explained. And then you just assume that's always going to be the case. And it's actually not, and this is true for all of life, but what happens here, and again, this is not a radiation medicine, radiation oncology problem, this is a life problem, is that things that we think the other person, the other party understands or knows about, they do not. And you end up talking past each other. And so this is actually the point of the MedNet as well. And I highly recommend people use the MedNet. The stated, or at least once upon a time, the stated goal of the MedNet was to take the hallway conversations and put them on the internet accessible for everyone. I think that was back in the day. Nadine said that at some point, but I love that. And so that's what I'm trying to do here, is that I want us all on the same page as much as possible, knowing that is an impossible goal, but I can contribute just a little bit. And there's two things that I find myself quoting a lot that people understand less than I thought they would. And this is a me problem. Obviously, I'm a weird kid. One is from the House of God, which is even before my time, which is, they can always hurt you more, things like that. That's less relevant for this. And maybe we'll do that in the future. I don't know. The other is Simone's Maxims. And Simone's Maxims is a paper from 1999, originally from 1999, from a Dr. Simone, who is in leadership positions in academic medical centers. And I find that they just get more and more relevant. Now, you might have to modify them a little bit in terms of language or in terms of word choice. But the sentiment, I don't want to be grandiose and say timeless, but the sentiments are excellent. And I think that sometimes, one, people don't know about them, which is weird to me, or two, people find them not applicable or find them too cynical, or I'm not quite sure. But I think it is important to hear about these or read them or however you want to phrase it, simply because I deeply believe that it is hard to draw the line in nuance of what feels like hyper-specific problems to our specialty, or when people like me are critical of certain things, that it's very specific and unique, and none of this is unique, and many things are just broad strokes applicable to insert industry here. And I think this kind of goes back to what I've been trying to do, which is get people past the camps of us versus them, which historically we're very dogmatic, box-based specialty of I am at this institution, or I am with this professional society, or that might work. It generally doesn't work, but that might work better in giant specialties. But there's really, in a 5,000-something doctor specialty, these tribal things don't do us any good. And the us versus them mentality has got to stop being Astro versus not Astro, or PPS exempt center versus not PPS exempt center. These distinctions do matter to a degree, but it is people who practice radiation medicine and the patients we take care of. And I don't even want to say everyone else, because then it's just this us versus them crap has got to stop. But so it's going to hit the highlights of Simone's maxims and intersperse some of it. So he wrote the original paper in 1999. Then he wrote a longer form. It's published in a book format, basically, but I will run through some of these and we'll direct people in the show description to where they can go read about them. But the point of this is to realize that history doesn't repeat, but it often rhymes, and we're just going to keep living the same mistakes over and over, and we've got to transcend that. It's an impossible goal, but if I just keep saying it into a microphone enough, maybe three people will listen. But so here is the final paragraph of the introduction for the original Simone's maxims.
These maxims concern the behavior of academic medical institutions, their leaders and their faculty from the individual's point of view. They were accumulated and developed from years of personal experience and many mistakes, as well as occasional revelations, both personal and borrowed from others. Although these maxims are personal, each is supported by the experience of some colleagues. I am confident that my experience is not unique, and that at least some will resonate with others in academic medicine, each of whom will have personal variations. The maxims are offered mainly to those below the full professor level, because they are less experienced, and also because we full professors tend to believe we know it all. They have grown and evolved over time, and they are likely to continue to do so. These are no tablets from Moses, to be sure. The maxims are contained in five categories: institutions, leadership, recruiting, job changes, and success.
Part of why I like this so much when I first came across it is he flat out states the core tenet of what I try to do here or elsewhere, is that these are maxims and that they are his experience, in that he is not claiming that these are statistically significant or that this is the absolute objective reality or all of that, because really that's all we can have is our experiences. And well, you can disagree with an opinion or a point of view or whatever. At the end of the day, they really are your opinions and experience, and that's the best any of us can ever hope for. And I don't honestly remember the first time I read this, how far in my career I was. I don't know how much I took these to heart or how much I believed. And it is certainly as I have gotten further and further along that they make more and more sense. Again, I read them not necessarily as literal translations into my own life or experience, but in terms of the sentiment. And which is why, if you have never heard of this paper or read this paper before, there's a high probability that somewhere along the road here, you have heard this first maxim, which is, of course, my favorite.
Institutions don't love you back. This first maxim may sound cynical, but the relationship between a trainee, faculty member, or any employee and the institution is impersonal and contractual, whether written or not. Institutional leaders must make decisions that are not personal, but usually have positive or negative personal consequences. One cannot expect the same consideration as one may receive in a family. Despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary, it is surprising how often even full professors believe they deserve special consideration because of loyalty, longevity, or past productivity. A wise colleague once told me that job security was the ability to move to another job, because of professional independence. One must keep in mind that institutional relationships are really with persons who can and sometimes do love you back. My fondest memories of places I've been are of co-workers and patients, not the institution. If they moved on, my attachment moved with them. For any one of us, good co-workers and solid leaders make what we value in the institution. Recognizing them, what they do for us, and the values they represent are far more important than loyalty to an impersonal institution.
I think that is the most important thing to remember in all of this, whatever word you want to call these bullet points. But it is also probably the hardest one to learn, because if you zoom out and think about where we all begin our careers, all we have is the institution, meaning that when you are applying to undergrad, to medical school, to residency, maybe fellowship, to job 1, 2, 3, whatever, especially in the beginning, but throughout your career and life, the institution is really the only entry point, both in reality and in abstract thought. So when you are thinking to yourself, I want to become a radiation oncologist, and what residency am I going to apply to? You don't apply to a colleague. You don't apply to a culture. You don't apply to a chair or program director necessarily, but you apply to the institution. And the way our minds work, we associate everything in that box. When you go, would you rank your number one residency choice in the match? That is the box you are putting all your hopes and dreams and future into, not to be grandiose or anything. I don't mean it that way, but it is then very hard to disentangle your perception of what that is in your mind to what is actually happening. And it is sometimes just not possible for some people, which is very reasonable if you think about it. And because it's painful to realize that the institution cannot love you back. It's really important to keep that in mind in general, because, and this is now where I would say institution and love and those things can mean many things. And you see this a lot in radiation oncology, simply because we are so small. There's not a lot of institutions for us to choose from. And in this next maxim bullet point, the way I read this one, it resonates with me in a literal sense. It's about institutional committees, but also expanding this concept out to a broader sense of the institution as a whole, or a job place as a whole, or any of that.
Members of most institutional committees consist of about 30% who will work at it, despite other pressures, and 20% who are idiots, status seekers, or troublemakers. The remainder consists of those who don't show up, attend because they have nothing better to do, or who can't or won't spend much energy on it. Not incidentally, this same percentage applies to boards of directors, who, I hasten to add, are the owners of non-profit institutions, such as academic medical centres. The higher up you go in such institutions, the more important it is to know into which category each trustee fits, because trustees have enormous influence and they turn over rarely. The most successful committees have hard-working chairmen who prepare themselves and the members before meetings, call meetings only when essential, and engage members in a productive manner. No academic committee meeting should exceed 60 minutes, preferably 50. No one ever complains of meetings being too short. Longer meetings are usually due to poor leadership, poor organization, or a lack of purpose.
I like that one because things feel a lot less painful to me, and I would hope that maybe others could see things the same way. When you realize that, when you start seeing the same patterns over and over again, and I have been in and around medicine now for 20 years, and it used to really bother me where in my mind, I was always waiting for the next level, which is how life always goes for us, where you say, I'm going to set this goal, and when I achieve that goal, everything will be okay. And a version of that will be, it's basically the grass is always greener. And I was getting very disillusioned, disenchanted with, it just felt everything I achieved, every next step where I went to, in some points of view, bigger and better places, things, achievements, whatever you want to say. And every single time it was just the same stuff. And you can really go two ways with that in terms of how you interact with it and how you feel about it. And reading this and kind of other things, but coming to see this pattern for what it is and knowing that it is probably, I am personally almost certain it's everywhere, but I could be wrong. I would say probably there is just a version of that sort of group makeup everywhere in every industry. And knowing that going in and working in that pattern instead of getting frustrated with it or by it or trying to change it, it makes things a lot easier. But that does roll into my second favorite. After Institutions Cannot Love You Back, which is the clear favorite, I don't know if I really have a clear 2, 3, 4, but this is probably, just based on my personal sort of experiences, my number 2 most favorite.
Leadership does matter. The ill effects of poor leadership at any level, from CEO to department head to housekeeping, insidiously permeate an entire institution. This invariably leads to inefficiency at best, and at worst leads to falling dominoes of lost opportunity or catastrophe. Leadership matters, even though its effectiveness may not be apparent in the short term. In fact, it is most effective when its workings and angst are not apparent to most of the people most of the time. In other words, don't let them see you sweat. What makes great leaders is not a secret. They not only have grace under pressure, which means both courage and character, they remain focused on the important aspects of an issue in the midst of chaos, and they repeatedly articulate a consistent, simple public vision. If the troops don't know what is expected of them, what direction is set, or what the leader values most, that is the leader's fault. However, this vision must be backed by public acts, not just words. There are many opportunities to demonstrate one's vision, both subtle and overt. Whom the leader hires, fires, and promotes sends the most effective signal, but smaller acts can indirectly express his or her values. Good leaders also usually choose to be judged by, and take satisfaction in, the success of the team members. Top leadership jobs are full-time jobs, and must be viewed as a new and specific career choice, not as a minor part-time duty.
Along the lines of the grass is always greener, we have the next maxim, which also, once you recognize this pattern, if you accept it, you don't have to like it. And by accept, I don't mean just be complacent. Know that it's not you or the situation, or it's an archetype. It's just a category. If you can know that and frame your perceptions and interactions as such, at least for me, it's less painful.
Leaders are often chosen primarily for characteristics that have little or no correlation with a successful tenure as leader. Examples of such criteria include a long bibliography, scientific eminence, institutional longevity, ready availability, a willingness to not rock the boat, or to accept inadequate resources. Choosing leaders is not a science, but it is surprising how often management skills, interpersonal skills, and experience are undervalued. This error is most damaging when recruiting clinical leaders because of the increasing complexity of healthcare economics and the interface of the academic mission with hospital functions. What should one look for? It differs, of course, depending on the position. One should ask what critical skills are absolutely essential for that role at that time, in that particular setting. There are usually only 2 or 3. It could be scientific taste as much as accomplishment, i.e., a keen sense of excellent versus average science, as opposed to the ability to run one's own program successfully. Or it might be in the trenches management experience, interpersonal skills, or the courage to clean house. My point is that we all want superb investigators, teachers, and clinicians, preferably able to walk on water, but there are other practical values that are at least as important and often define the success or failure of the leader.
This next piece, it's not a maxim per se, but his own reflections on the maxims. This is where the books, in my opinion, the book starts to get antiquated and diverge from current events, as it were. part of where I want to take this and other episodes is redefining, or not even redefining, but having a conversation about what our classic definitions and categories of what we do are, what they mean, what words we use. Because when you got to remember, this original, the Maxims, were written in 1999. That was Mars. That was a different planet. And I no longer really know what academic radiation oncology means. And what I mean by that is that with healthcare consolidation, what you have just through, I was about to say natural, but natural and unnatural market forces, is the incentive for people to team up and get bigger and bigger. And there are quite a lot of jobs in the community that used to be private practice, meaning that there was no academic system, there was no medical school associated in any official capacity with a job or a hospital. And that is increasingly uncommon. And what this has done is really, when, especially in radiation oncology, these terms used to have so much meaning. And not to say that they don't anymore, but when we talk about an academic radiation oncologist versus a community or private radiation oncologist, and or private practices in a PSA or professional services agreement, or private practices in a W-2 employed radiation oncologist, there's just not, the lines are so blurry, they almost don't exist anymore. And he was talking about it. So Simone wrote this like reflection book thing in 2008-2009, and it's very salient because he often references the Great Recession, that was the housing crisis that was happening. And it does have a lot of parallels to academic medicine, academic oncology, and certainly academic radiation oncology. But the broader point here is that this system that we are in was designed and built in a different world, and it was archaic 20 years ago, and I don't even know what's a step above archaic, but let's hear how this used to be described in the way back of 2008.
One might say that the traditional university medical center is archaic, an attempted adaptation of the university structure first developed in medieval times. In more recent times, this may have worked with the German model of the 19th century, also adopted in other European countries, i.e. the all-inclusive department or focused institute, headed by Herr Professor. The professor usually had a management role of the clinical facility and total authority over operations, appointments and such. The economics were relatively simple. The professor was paid by the state for his university work, and he often had a lucrative private practice on the side. His aides were paid peanuts, if they were paid at all. This model persists in parts of Italy. Today's university medical center in America, that developed its present shape after World War II, is an entirely different entity. It is a big business that often is suffocating under the fusion, or confusion, of competing demands using structural models with conflicting missions. It has not fully adapted to the financial and social realities of the day that profoundly influence its ability to carry out the academic mission. Thus, we see the increasing strength of freestanding cancer centers and research institutes, both of which have a more unified vision of their missions. The fact that some university medical centers are doing quite well, academically and financially, is a reflection of their elite status and/or being quickly adaptable to contemporary realities. Most university medical centers have done neither, despite the best efforts of many faculty and staff, because of poor leadership, glacial responses to societal change, or an ingrained satisfaction with mediocrity.
And then one last little piece from Dr. Simone himself for this particular episode that I think we should maybe carve into a bronze tablet and have it hung. We probably need a couple bronze tablets, and then we can all vote on where we should hang them.
Academia is fertile ground for hubris to grow because the professorial ranks, the obsession with national rankings, and the pomp and ceremony create an atmosphere of superiority. It is a short step to believing that one's long CV, multitudes of grants, and many honours that academics give one another have created a superior, all-knowing being. The next step is arrogance, often evident by treating those below one's rank dismissively and impolitely. If the individual is very successful or powerful in academic terms, there is a slippery slope down to hubris.
And just to bring this full circle, the intent of this particular episode was or is to try to maintain a sort of shared language and understanding, and that when we are talking to each other about systemic issues or systemic improvements or whatnot, trying to make sure they're all coming from a similar background or point of view. Not to say that this is, by any stretch of the imagination, some sort of thing that used to be taught or whatnot. I don't know. I mostly mean to say that I would consider this, in a sense, part of the hidden curriculum, but that it is very helpful for a few reasons. One, that it provides a level of wisdom, I guess you could say, again, circling back to the institutions, about how we feel about ourselves, really, where there's a lot of pressure in this career to make certain choices. And at the end of the day, the only person that can live your life is you. And when you make choices, you have to make sure that you are making the ones that you want. Because if you feel pressure from your institution to pick a certain path, to study a certain topic, to study anything at all, if you feel pressure from the institution and or feel like you need to do something because that's just the way it is, or and it's not necessarily aligned with what you want for your life, it is very hard to acknowledge that, number one, and even harder, number two, to do it. But we get one shot at this, and I think that's just very important to keep in mind. And the other point being that I think it's interesting to consider how someone would hear or read or think about these maxims based on where they are in their career. Because I suspect, mostly because I probably was this person, and I know in real life many people like this, as events in your own life change and you experience things, how you perceive the truth or wisdom or, again, whatever word you want to use in these statements is going to change. And they might feel foolish or ridiculous. At one point, they might feel like the most impactful things you've ever read, or maybe they make you feel nostalgic. I don't know. But I think that's the other thing to keep in mind when reflecting on these things, is that it's okay to change opinions and thoughts and viewpoints, because that's the name of the game. And I think where we get stuck a lot in certainly medicine and definitely radiation oncology is that once you form an opinion, you think that's it. It's baked in. This is how it is. And your perception or how you interact with a piece of content or writing or audio or video or whatever, stone tablets, cave paintings, it will change. Or at least it should. And if it doesn't, then you don't want to be stuck. And I think specifically there's other maxims and things that I didn't cover for this one, but I take a look at the issues surrounding current radiation oncology. And there's a lot of, if you ask what's the barrier to improvement, to progress, there's a lot of siloing and let's go with groupthink, which I think is a word that Dr. Simone uses in the book portion of this. But the way that we are structured, and again, this goes back to culture, is that we talk about these things, we write about specifically radiation oncology as if there is a collective, and there is, but at the end of the day, everyone is operating on a local level, meaning each person, and I'm just going to now get hyper-focused on radiation. I know people who are not in this field listen to this sometimes, but insert your thing here. Each department has individuals that are each acting usually in their own self-interest. And I don't mean that in a negative way. It's just how it is to survive. So you have each person is making decisions and engaged in actions to benefit themselves and the people around them. And then the leadership of that one department is engaged in whatever is necessary, not only on an individual level personally, but then also in the group in their department. They are influenced by the forces of the institution that they're in. And by institution, it doesn't have to be an academic institution. It can be any hospital, it can be anything. And so then they're trying to navigate the forces of the institution that they are a part of, which is then at the state level, because medicine is a very state-regulated endeavor. And you have to compete with that, where for us, things like certificate of needs might be very aggressive and difficult in one state and might not even exist in another. But when you read things that are put out at the alleged national level, like professional societies such as ASTRO, where if you look, ASTRO is mainly led by people who are from institutions with residency programs. I'm painting in very broad strokes, but it's generally historically been the case. And there's about 1,200 academic faculty at those residency-associated institutions, and there's somewhere north of 5,000 radiation oncologists in the country. It's really 20% of all of us are the ones driving the opinions. An entity cannot have an opinion. An organization cannot have an opinion. It is not a living, breathing thing, and it could be fluid. But you then have each individual group that makes up the bigger group is acting. It's the tragedy of the commons. And I think that it's important to take a step back. And it's really hard to see if you're a resident, where you only know one thing, and it's just the way it is. There's no, this is why I like living in 2023, although soon it'll be 2024. But what I'm doing now, the podcast, or like what the BedNet does, or what the artist formerly known as Twitter or Student Doctor, what that has done for us is allowed us to have these conversations. If you think about 1992, and if you think we are siloed now, if I say that we're siloed now, I can't even imagine what it was like in 1992 when none of this existed. And it's a miracle that we made it this far at all, really, because it is just so hard. America's a big place, and which may seem silly to say, but I think people don't really grasp how unwieldy this can be, and that what one department might think of as normal, and or even more striking, what one department would think of as borderline malpractice. We're talking about like treatment techniques. If you go two states over, that might be the normal for them, that borderline malpractice thing. And this is not talked about, because before there wasn't really a forum for that. And along those lines, where with just the groupthink problem, there's just a fear of being marginalized. And you saw this a lot back at the peak of the competitiveness of radiation oncology, where you just felt lucky to be here. And so you would have necessary self-censorship because there was that looming threat that never really needed to be spoken, that if you rock the boat, there are a legion of people waiting to take your place. Don't rock the boat. And this is certainly something that I have experienced, weirdly, not since doing the podcast, which is certainly strange. But if you've been in and around academic politics for long enough, you see this all the time. And I think it's important to realize, and again, the big point why I weirdly just talk to myself with a microphone in my hand, is diversity of opinion is key. The trap we fell into that caused so many issues and so much turmoil in radiation oncology recently really comes from groupthink. It really comes from a singular point of view and fear of marginalization and not having debate. And this is, I'd try as a rule to really avoid politics or anything about that sort, but it's polarization, and it's unhealthy when you have really, really polarized opinions and lack of nuance. And I think we have the capacity to do better. And I think we do. I see it every day. And that's the frustrating thing, is you see on a local level, See it all the time. See it day to day. And I think we can apply that on a national level. And I think the easiest thing is to just be open to other opinions. And you can disagree with them. You can love them. You can hate them. But you got to hear them. You got to have them. Or we're essentially the ostriches of medicine. And we like basements, but we shouldn't like sand.
This has been a Photon Media production. Don't forget to like and subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen to us. Be well and beam on.